Welcome to the First Things podcast. In this episode, news comes that millennials are avoiding sex for all the wrong reasons. Editor Rusty Reno and senior editor Mark Bauerlein will try to pin down what's going on with the young generation. Then, what is the elephant graph and why does it matter? Rusty and Mark will discuss the historic decoupling of the elites from the middle classes and what it means for democratic politics in the West. Then I'll break out a few aphorisms on youth and age to stump my colleagues. I'm Associate Editor Julia Yost. Thanks for joining us. There's a story that's been pinging around the internet for a couple of weeks. It appeared in the Washington Post as, "There isn't really anything magical about it, why more millennials are avoiding sex." It reports on a recent study showing that the millennial generation is having less sex and with fewer partners than the preceding generations did at the same age, Generation X and the baby boomers. A couple data points. Millennials report fewer sexual partners than any age cohort since the 1960s, an average of 8, down from 11 for the baby boomers. The percentage of high school students who had sex last year is 41, down from 54 in 1991. Why is this? Have millennials come to see that sex belongs within sacramental marriage? No, indeed. The Washington Post offers a mix of anecdotal reasons, including careerism, the pervasiveness of social media, the pervasiveness of dating apps and consequent decline of stable relationships, the pervasiveness of pornography, nervousness about issues of consent, and fear of emotional involvement, or what the kids call catching feelings. There are some great quotes in the article. One kid says, "Sexual experience is not going to be something people ask you for on your resume." Another kid says, "It's not like I'm saving myself for anything. It's more like I've been busy." A third kid says, "I'm curious about sex, like I'm curious how a new sandwich would taste, but it's not a driving curiosity." So Rusty and Mark, what has happened to my generation?
That's the question we ask every day, every morning. We wake up with that question on our minds. I would say that all of the speculations in the Washington Post article, which the researchers in the clinical study, actually it wasn't a clinical study, it was a statistical study taken from the General Social Survey, that those all sound right to me. You know, what the proportions are, that's going to vary, but all that figures in my sense. Certainly the internet has produced what back in the 1950s a lot of social scientists, when they saw television growing, they called an atomism taking place. People becoming cocooned in their houses too much, watching their TVs. Mm. I think this phenomenon is a lot of teenagers, a lot of college students, they cocoon in their rooms because they've turned their room into a virtual social space.
My sense is that there's a strong impulse to self-protection in the rising generation. Probably stems from a lot of causes. I mean, they face a much more competitive marketplace. And so the great quote from the careerist who says, you know, where is this going to show up on my resume? Well, that's easy to laugh at, but I remember a New York Times piece on the hookup culture at Penn and these high-achieving women saying that they didn't have time for serious relationships. So there does seem to be this strong, the achievement culture does seem to be sort of oddly pushing these things to the side. And then the need to protect yourself against, the sexual culture is more dangerous emotionally probably than it's been for a long time. And so it's natural that students might want to back away, I think. I mean, I think the article had the thing about how, you know, the dating apps are, again, it's back to this competitive thing. The dating apps kind of reduce everything to whether he or she is good looking. And when you meet somebody face to face, you have a chance to kind of make a play for them with all of your charm.
And your intangibles.
And your intangibles, yeah. And your charm, your smile, your wit. And so the allure of the other person is much more complex and rich in a face-to-face, but if it's just pictures, then it becomes, I think the way in which the pornographic culture has kind of degraded our sexual imagination to purely physical gets reinforced by the fact you're looking at, is she good looking enough? Is she thin enough? Is she this or is he that?
You know, one thing about the vulnerability issue is, as we've had more and more sexual freedom and openness, at the same time, sexuality has become more dangerous in this way. In order to fend off some of the complications of abuses that some sexual situations are prone to, the culture, the institutions, the authorities have tried to convert sexual relations into an entirely rational process. And this comes down to things like, in California, the insistence that with every step of a process between a college student, male and a female, or whatever, one obtains consent.
Right. Yes, you know, means yes.
It's all rationalized along the way.
Arms length negotiation.
Desire isn't rational.
But also, we're sending a message to the kids that, hey, this is so dangerous.
Exactly. And so when the irrationalities, when the complications and confusions arise, that everything about their acculturation, at least among the achievement kids, is to step back, to pull away. This is something that could step out of control. I'm on a track. I'm pursuing something. I've got ambitions. I want to succeed. This could be treacherous.
Right. Also, right. Yeah, and the safety culture generally, you know, wear helmets when you're on your bike. Right. You know, you tell Johnny when he goes out the door, wear your helmet, wear your helmet.
Right.
So everything is surrounded by danger for young people. And sex is dangerous. It's always been emotionally dangerous.
But notice how...
Physically dangerous.
In the post story, what strikes me is the casting of sexuality as such a surface, casual choice.
Hmm.
There's no depth of desire. Where's the passion? Where is the...
You mean in the quotes?
From the kids? Well, you know, I'm just too busy. Or, you know, the second one you mentioned, Julia, about sex is like trying something on a menu. For them, and I want to say, look, haven't you ever fallen head over heels in love? Haven't you ever, you know, sat late in bed all night thinking about that perfect woman, that perfect guy? Where is it?
That's what I think is most horrifying to me about this article. Just the amazing shallowness that seems to have come over my generation. I mean, you know, as someone who studied literature, I think to myself, how would I pitch Dante to a generation that thinks about sex in these terms? You know, it's as interesting to me as a sandwich that I've never tried.
Right.
It's so banalizing, right. And that's just
what do they think of Anna
really
Karenina?
Dreadful.
what do they think of Dmitri, Karamazov?
I think it reflects the one very... It's a classical defensive strategy, apathy. Apatheia means passionlessness. And it's a cultivated state of life where you try to moderate your passion so that you won't be swept away. Also, you won't be hurt. So I think I keep circling back to the impulse that I see in young people, which is an impulse of protection, self-protection.
And where does religion factor into this? You know, I think one might have assumed that where religion declines, libertinism springs up. You know,
right.
We saw that in the 60s, all right, but now there's a sort of, it seems that the farther we get away from a thoroughly religious culture, the less even libido people have. So what is with
that's
correlation?
That's a great insight. The most You know, the kind of ground zero for the desexualization of youth is Japan. Mm-hmm. And they talk about celibacy syndrome, researchers, young people who have basically withdrawn from any kind of interest in sex life. Something like 20% of Japanese youth say they have no interest in having sex. And there was some study, it was a great, what's wrong with the Japanese? You know, 50% of Japanese said they had not had sexual contact in the previous month. 50%, that's pretty high. But it's also the most secular society. You're often described as the most secular society in the world. So I ask, is there a correlation? Paradoxically, because we've been told for so long that Christianity is the great enemy of the body, Christianity hates pleasure, etc., etc. Could it paradoxically be that secularism is actually anti-body, anti-pleasure, anti-sex?
Does it have to do with the sense in which the loss of religion makes people more risk-averse, perhaps?
Well, there's an ecstatic quality to religiosity. You go outside of yourself to try to reach the transcendent. And John Paul II, you know, his whole theology of the body is an attempt to show that in our emotional lives and in our sexual lives, but sex understood much more broadly than the physical act, in the union of men and women, there's that same going outside of oneself. So there's a venturing, so risking, his famous slogan, be not afraid, I think speaks to that. And so it could be the case that a secular society is one where people are not encouraged to go outside of themselves. And so they eventually kind of get trapped and fear to venture out towards the other.
Yeah, I don't see any inverse correlation between the intensity of religious faith and the intensity of desire and passion.
Right, I mean, Dante is a good example where Dante sees, and I think this is St. Augustine, that lust is passion wrongly directed. So it's the final of the seven deadly sins that has to be purged, and it's lust. And the penitents are behind a veil of fire that separates Dante from them. They kind of emerge out of the kind of sea of fire, and he sees their faces. And Dante himself has to go through that veil of fire to get to the mountain, to paradise, top of the mountain of purgatory. And so that our passions don't have to be, they have to be purified rather than dampened. So he has to go through the fire because he has to actually heighten his love for God, his desire for God, not diminish it. So I think it's Dante's very insightful there and recognizes that a misdirected passion is the least grievous sin because it at least has that power in it to drive one outside of oneself.
Dante was a wise man.
Religious faith provides a structure for passion. It provides an orientation. It gives it direction and it gives it a boundedness. Millennials don't see any structure for sexual activity at this point. It's not part of courtship in many cases. It's not leading toward marriage. It's not leading toward children. It can't really be accommodated to an individual career very well. So it is no wonder that in the study we see while the sexual behavior has gone down, there is a steady incidence of the casual nature of it. They're not forming fewer and more intense sexual relationships. The ones that they even do form are often just of a very superficial nature.
I think the other really, really horrifying trend is, so there's an increase in casual encounters, and there seems to be a huge increase, this isn't news, but a huge increase in porn consumption. And that one, I think, seems to be bad news for Christian morality in a way that the rest of it isn't quite.
It's hitting young boys at age 13, 14, and 15 before they have the intellectual and emotional equipment even to know what they're looking at.
Yeah. And it seems to me that the effect of this sort of cocooning in porn experience, it's very insulating. It insulates them from Eros as a contact sport in which somebody could get hurt or hurt another or have cause to regret something. And it seems to have insulated them from a sense of sin or shame. Mm-hmm. One of the things that struck me so much is that there's a guy named Noah Patterson who's quoted in this article, and he professes openly that he far prefers porn and autoeroticism to going on dates. He not only gave his full name and hometown, but allowed them to take his picture, which you can see in the article. And I'm struck by the total absence of shame over a vice that used to be just classically shame-inducing, mm-hmm. you know? And so if that reaction has been completely disabled in many or most millennials, and also they're not engaging, for the most part, in the kinds of relationships that could cause someone to get hurt or cause regret in a serious way, how does Christian morality even begin to get traction on these people? They've organized their lives such that there's sort of no opening into the idea of sin and redemption. I don't know even how we begin to speak to these people.
I'm with you, Julia. We're a long way. You know, what's interesting is that the Washington Post writer, in an odd way, shares with us a kind of horror. There are a lot of secular folks who are thinking, well, whoa, wait a minute, where did things go so wrong? So maybe that's a place to start. Some shared sense that, you know, the human person is kind of made for others, made, and that, you know, that pleasure is not a bad thing, and that it should be an evolving thing and not a commodity to be consumed.
I
think that's a pretty widespread consensus that people feel that there's something wrong right now. And that's a good place to start.
I don't think that young man is lost. He's saying this because no one has ever told him this is not something that you want other people to know about. You have to understand, and I think he would understand if he were told a few times, young man, what are you doing? Something's missing there in his life, in the others around him.
We should stage an intervention. We can probably track him down on Facebook. This is about distance and detachment and a kind of historic decoupling between the top and the bottom in the West that did not, in more moderate times, exist. That's how Peggy Noonan began her column last week in the Wall Street Journal. She points to Germany. Angela Merkel has opened the borders at the expense of regular people who do not have the resources to meet the burden, who have no particular protection or money or connections. And when the folks object, they are called irrational and xenophobic, and so disqualified from civic discourse. Frau Merkel and other elite decision makers get the enlightened applause. Noonan sees this situation as emblematic of something that's happening all over the West. The elite, government officials, but also the international business elite, are detached from ordinary folks. They don't feel accountable to them. They have contempt for them. They are not loyal to any nation, much less any citizenry. Their ideals are transnational. It's interesting to see this critique in the Journal, which is the paper of record for the global business elite, anyway. Noonan says that the disloyalty and deracination of our elites is odd. She can't quite account for it. Rusty?
I found the piece was helpful statement on Noonan's part about something that I've been turning over in my head now for a while. Can you go back to the Romney campaign when he referred to 47% of America as so-called takers? And then you get the New York Times editorial page now, Trump voters are racists or xenophobes or Christians are haters. And we could go on and on. It really is striking You know, Ronald Reagan was a very ideologically committed guy. So it's not just ideological divisions in our country. Something else seems to be going on, because he didn't talk that way. Bill Clinton didn't talk that way. Commentators in that era didn't talk that way. And it made me realize, what is going on? It's not just partisan division. Or maybe it's not just partisan division. And this summer I read Branko Milanovic's book called Global Inequality, I think a new approach in an age of globalization. And in that book, the center of that book, and it's very popular, you can find it on the web, is the so-called elephant graph. And what the body of the elephant is this big hump, and it shows rise in income for middle class folks in the developing world, China, India, Brazil, places like that. It's a big cohort of people. They've really benefited in the last 20 years since the fall of communism. The new global regime has been very good for them. And then the front of the elephant dips down towards his trunk, goes all the way down. And at that level, we get the middle class in the developed world, the rich world. They've seen no income growth in the last 20 to 30 years. And then the trunk of the elephant rises up very rapidly. And that trunk is the global elite. And they have also seen really very dramatic rises in income. And that graph helped me see that the leadership class in the West no longer shares fundamental interests with the middle class in the West. And the more I thought about it, the more I thought, well, if I'm a cynical counselor to some sort of, you know, special secret meeting of the American leadership class, these are all kind of, you know, mythical notions, but they're real, then I would advise that leadership class to figure out how to detach themselves from the dead weight of the failing middle class in America. Now, we can't do that democratically, because we have a system of government that requires voters to actually vote for you. But you could say, well, let's work on cultural disenfranchisement and say these people are illegitimate voices because they are racists or they're haters, or they're illegitimate voices because they're dependent upon government, they're takers. This isn't the left and then the right, this way of talking. It reflects a deep divergence of fundamental interests in the global system as it's emerging today. It's kind of dark thought, you know. That's a big, big problem for our society. If the people running the country are fundamentally different interests than the people who populate the country, I don't see how you can sustain a democratic culture.
You know, Noonan's column and some other commentators have talked about how the policies so often supported by the financial political elite really are born, though the burden is born by this the masses. And the way you put it, Rusty, you proceed to support those policies then by disenfranchising them culturally. And I think here's what I've seen, that elite does have a cultural elite, or maybe an intellectual elite, that supplies them with the contempt that they need to discredit these people. And being in academia for decades and circulating and among some reporters and journalists and so on, I've seen this contempt expressed without pause. I mean, it was just automatic to sit there with my Ivy League colleagues who have all the right progressive liberal opinions about things, and the mere mention of someone who lives in rural Georgia who may be evangelical and who has the wrong issues on sex and marriage, just the bile that comes out of people's mouths. Right. They can't even talk about them as human beings. They drip with contempt for them. The depth of conviction, I find extraordinary. So there's a very deep
It's a cultural disenfranchisement.
Yeah, but Rusty, it goes very deep.
Right.
It's not just a strategy they come up with and then they implement it.
No, there's not. It's not a. This is not a. I mean, human beings are complex, and so we're fallen, and in our fallen state, we often align our interests with our convictions, and so. So we our ideals are conveniently coordinated with what best serves our interests. But I think I see kind of three elements of this decoupling. One is this cultural disenfranchisement, where these people don't have a right to talk because their motives are bad and they're wicked in some way. Another is multiculturalism. It's a kind of it's a sort of pivoting gun. It's an ill-defined ideology, but one thing is quite consistent: is it's used to diminish people's patriotic loyalty. So someone like Howard Zinn is a great textbook if your goal is to disenfranchise ordinary people. Patriotism is a very powerful instrument of accountability that binds the leader to the led and makes them accountable to those that they lead. And then finally, utilitarianism. It's astonishing to me how quickly, how now we've transformed all political questions into wonk policy questions. And ordinary people are not qualified to speak on complex matters of what is the most likely to promote the greatest good for the greatest number. Only experts can speak. And I think that's another element of disenfranchisement.
Oh, I think that's certainly true. I mean, you see that, you saw that in the Brexit debate.
Right. Yeah. Ordinary people are not qualified to vote on whether to stay in the EU or not. They don't understand, you know, the economic implications, et cetera, et cetera.
And the reaction against the outcome of the Brexit vote was, so much of it that I heard was couched in terms of expertise. You know, if the experts had been listened to, the people would have understood that this is, in a utilitarian way, bad for Britain. And it's just, it doesn't occur to the people who are making this argument that it could be the voters of Britain, A, had non-utilitarian reasons that nevertheless are legitimate for making the decision that they made. And B, I mean, honestly, the experts aren't always right about stuff.
Look,
I mean, it's statistically a fact that they're more likely
to
get things wrong than the educated general reader is when we're talking matters of prediction.
No, I've given up on, you know, reading op-eds on monetary policy. These people don't know what works and what doesn't work. Because for every economist who says X, you can get an economist who says not X. But it does, that discourse has a way of disenfranchising ordinary folks. You know, I think our distempers, our political distempers, may have as much to do with this as the overt political issues that are presented. We've got Republicans going over to Hillary. You know, there's lots of reasons to not want Donald Trump be president of the United States, but I worry that it's a first sign that the American elite is basically going to go into coalition, as they've done in France and increasingly in Germany, in order to fend off any populist challenge, regardless of its source.
Yeah, that was, I think, the question I wanted to end with. I've been wondering what happens to Trumpism after Trump. I'm assuming he's going to lose, but it seems to me the question is what will turn out to have been the significance of his candidacy, whether he loses or wins. Maybe we're going to think that Trump was causative of whatever ensues afterward. Maybe we'll think he was symptomatic of whatever ensues. Maybe we'll think he was just an aberration and our politics is going to revert to neoliberal type. But does the elephant graph delineate the new contours of American politics? Are the Democrats going to become the party of the deracinated elite and the Republicans the party of loyalty and locality? Or are we going to continue to see these anti-establishment factions within each party? Or will it all just go back to normal? Any guesses?
It doesn't seem likely to go back to normal because these are such deep, deep, deep trends in our society that are coming to the fore. I think 9/11 masked a lot of this because the external enemy united us. And Trump is certainly not causative, but rather his particular, he's a sort of evil genius, politically speaking. He's able to bring this to the fore. important ways. I don't think the Democratic, the parties are going to, one's going to be a populist party, another is a non-populist party. That doesn't seem plausible to me. The Democratic strategy is to keep that elite base relationship kind of in sync by, you know, really dramatizing the fact that without the elite to protect them from the haters, their lives would be much worse. And the Republican Party is in much worse shape because it has lost its ability to the elite to manage its relation to its base. It doesn't have a clear way to reassure its base that the leaders really do have the interests of the led at heart.
I would say that the consolidation of free market economics, globalism, and progressivist social policy they're not going to stop. They are committed to that, which means that the populist reaction against those two things, for whatever reasons is happening, is not going to go away. I don't know what form it's going to take after the election. I think you're going to see a whole lot of estranged citizens in the United States who simply tune out. They check out from our political reality. And how they do that, again, I think we're in a volatile time. But this the group psychology or social psychology is at work. They're going to find their way out one way or another.
Yeah, it seems like there just has to be a reckoning. You know, we're already seeing versions of that in the Brexit vote and the Trump campaign. Whether these reckonings turn out ever to be really potent or just more than symbolic, mm-hmm. I think remains to be seen. And if they do remain mostly symbolic, right, will populism fizzle or will it become more explosive?
Yeah, I think I agree with you, Julia, that there's going to be some kind of reckoning. I think we're at the end of the post-war era, that after the war in 1945, there was a big boom, and what was good for the CEO, you know, the managers of General Motors and the shareholders of General Motors was good for the working man in Detroit and throughout the United States. So there was a harmony of interests there that lasted well into the 70s and maybe even into the 80s. We had an external enemy, the Soviet Union. So our very survival depended upon the unity of the leaders in the led. Since the fall of the Soviet Union, that dimension has declined. And then, of course, the economic transformations have led to this disharmony of interests. And so I just think that our political system was set up on the assumption of a fundamental harmony of interests with the middle class and the leadership class. And we've yet to reorder our political culture around this more difficult problem, what to do in a society where really thriving is a kind of global project. But the nation state is with the political project. I mean, the solution is clearly to set aside the nation state, to sort of put that to bed and evolve towards a global system of governance. Because then you can align in a global system the elites with the huge middle class in the developing world. If our elites can figure out a way to maneuver beyond the nation state, I think they'll opt for that, and it's all dressed up in all sorts of moralistic, cosmopolitan moralism about how this is actually, you know, serving humanity. I'm deeply suspicious of this way of thinking because it seems like you're going to sacrifice not yourself but your neighbor for this. Who's going to actually
serve some humanity?
Right.
We'll end with a game of Name That Aphorist. I have three aphorisms, each on the theme of youth and age. Rusty and Mark, you each get one guess per aphorism. So who wrote it? First aphorism. The conversation of the old and young ends generally with contempt or pity on either side.
Mark Twain.
Montaigne.
Samuel Johnson. But good guesses both. Second aphorism. Old men and comets have been reverenced for the same reason, their long beards and pretenses to foretell events.
Now that Mark Twain,
that
sounds, was born,
that sounds like Twain.
Twain was born
the year of
Halley's Comet. I'm going to go with Mark Twain.
He also died in the year of Halley's Comet.
Another reason to go with Mark Twain.
I like Twain, but I have to guess. I have to guess someone else. Let's say Henry David Thoreau.
Jonathan Swift.
Swift.
Oh.
Okay.
Third aphorism. The universities are a sort of lunatic asylum for keeping young men out of mischief.
Whoa. Ambrose Bierce.
Good guess.
E.M. Forster.
Bishop Creighton.
Who is Bishop
Creighton? I have no idea, but I thought that one was so perfect.
Very good.
So it's a tie. Congrats to both of you.
0-0.
It's a soccer score. That's it for this episode of the First Things podcast. Thanks to my colleagues, Rusty Reno and Mark Bauerlein. Thanks to Bishop Creighton, whoever you are. And thank you, listeners. ¶¶